This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends to the 15th edition of Word for Word. I'd like to thank you for tuning in today. My name's Benjamin Norris and this is a 16-week series where we're getting to know Australia's LGBTI influencers. Each week, we will sit down with those who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community. Today, our guest is a filmmaker, well, not from Australia, from New Zealand. This man has been making cinema since his early 20s that has spoken to the community in such a way that his name is renowned right around the world. One of his first jobs was working in gay cinema where he cut his teeth with some very interesting editing duties. Is that right?
Yeah, it is.
I thought that was impressive. With a challenging relationship with his sexuality, he fled New Zealand for London and has experience working at Channel 4 on the British network. With countless films under his belt, he arrives in Australia to talk about his latest film, 100 Men. I would like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Paul Oramland.
The front page of the Daily Mail was Paul Oramland admitted homosexual, you know. I was part of a movement that wanted change and saw change, and that change has really happened.
What do you think makes a good filmmaker?
Oh, telling a story. It's an exploration of how things have changed for gay men through a countdown of people I've had sex with.
I didn't come back to New Zealand to explore a gay scene.
Is it strange to hear it all back like that?
Yes, it is really, because you don't, you know, I mean, it doesn't, you know, the word renown, you sort of think that's silly. You know, I'm just a filmmaker working hard on the things I believe and am passionate about.
The way you need to look at it is that you've got a small amount of notoriety in a particular field. For people who love cinema and for people who love queer cinema, they would know your name. And so you are renowned.
Absolutely. And you know, when I started out, it was pioneering. I mean, you know, one of the first things I ever did for Channel 4, it was raised in the House of Parliament and they wanted the channel taken off the air as a result. And I literally caught the tube in the morning, the underground, and there on the front page of the Daily Mail was a whole article about Paul Oramland admitted homosexual, you know. So it was, yeah, and I was part of a movement that wanted change and saw change, and that change has really happened.
What about the name Oramland? Where does that come from?
It's a weird one. It's actually, my parents were both refugees from the Second World War. My father was Jewish, as indeed my mum, and he was from Poland, but he was sent to New Zealand as part of a sort of group of people that were sent away, much like they did in the UK, to sort of get them out of trouble, not realizing what was coming. And then as a result, obviously, the world was turned upside down and the rest of his family were wiped out. So he was an orphan in New Zealand where he met my mum and she came out after the war. So, I mean, their story, you know, particularly my mum, who, you know, it's a total Anne Frank story. It's very bizarre. My mum hid upstairs when the trucks came and took her mum and dad away, you know. But it's
horrific.
Yeah, it's a completely unthinkable, you know, world. Yeah, so that's where the name comes from.
What were you like as a child?
So I was brought up in, a very religious environment, which clearly was not particularly supportive of gay people, to say the least. And I guess fairly early on, I realised I was probably about 10 or 11 when I first sort of started to sort of fantasize about guys. And then by about 13, I sort of began to put two and two together and realized that this was not the done thing and started to struggle with it.
What about your parents? Like when you did get to that age where you were working out your sexuality, do you think that they had an idea of your sexuality before they approached you with it?
It came up in roundabout sort of ways. And I think they suspected and they eventually asked me. And it was a time when I'd met someone and fallen in love, so I just came out. And they said, well, you know, I want you to go and see a psychiatrist. So I went to a psychiatrist and he offered, at that point they were experimenting with all sorts of weird drugs. which I think was a form of LSD, which, you know, looking back on it, maybe it might have been fun. But the reality is he suggested this as an option. And I think that won my parents round when I said I really didn't want to start taking, you know, mind-altering drugs to get rid of my sexuality.
What did you say to your parents when they suggested that you needed to look into this type of therapy?
No, look, they realized that that was extreme and not something that was right. And in a sort of strange way, and look, credit to them, you know, they're from a different generation, and they did their best to understand. And in subsequent years, my mum came to love my boyfriend and calls him son-in-law and absolutely embraces it and has come around. And even my dad, in his own way, he actually became very fond of my partner and, in fact, got on better with my partner than he did with me. And that's the irony of it all.
He probably had different qualities that he brought to the table that maybe as a father you think, oh, I wish that my son had this, you know.
Yeah, you know, my partner's into old motor cars and they used to sit and talk about old motor cars for hours on end.
Could you think of anything worse?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Do you think that in any way the way you were as a child changed as you came into your adult life?
Look, this goes in a strange sort of way to the heart of the documentary I've just made, 100 Men. I mean, initially it was leading a double life, and at school it was unthinkable that one would be openly gay or out in those days, because it was totally taboo, and it was. And I hid it and led a double life for a period of time. And then when I met my first boyfriend, Ian, I came out, I was proud. And I think one of the things is very early on I began to identify, and I use the word outsider. And I remember I discovered all sorts of taboo literature in the library, you know, fabulous writers like Jean Genet and William Burroughs. There's a wonderful I love science fiction, and there's a wonderful gay science fiction writer called Samuel Delaney, who also writes sort of this weird mixture of science fiction and hardcore porn. It's just the most, and he's a fantastically well-respected, and he's now elderly. He's also black and American, and he puts it all together in a way that I've never, you know, I'm a great fan. But I discovered all these people, and they were writing about things that, I mean, they were my dark secret. And I remember I was 16 and reading Jean Genet and jacking off to it, but at the same time absorbing the outsider, the sense of being special, not being part. And I began to feel special. So in a way, it almost gave me confidence, and I became proud. And I came out and became political, and I became an activist and started to explore gay rights. And that gave me the opposite. I became confident.
When I grew up in the 90s, nobody felt comfortable about coming out with their sexuality. So how old were you when you were comfortably out enough to be acknowledging that to other kids at school?
Oh, look, I came out when I was 17, and my friends at school were completely horrified, didn't know how to cope. But by that time I was in love, and I was already, you know, I was already saying, screw you, I'm gay, I'm proud, I'm going to explore things. And
wow.
And in a way, you know, one of the interesting things, and 100 Men, in a way, this is what the film is also trying to explore. Things have changed in a way that's fantastic. And later on in the UK, one met prejudice and was queer bashed, and leave aside things like the psychiatrist. But whereas it's fantastic now, there's a sense of equality that really has been achieved. But one of the people in the film says, look, I always wanted equality, but I didn't want to be the same. And there is I fear that, and I talk to young gay people, and I'll throw it to you, a number of young gay men have said to me, and I'm talking men rather than, you know, gay women or trans, but a number of young people, particularly even some who've seen the film, they say, well, this is amazing, but I don't want to be defined by my sexuality. And yet, in a way, I did. You know, that to me was very important and still is.
I always thought, in a lot of ways, there's a culture of being gay when I came out. So there was like a sound to the voice that was very distinguished for gay people. There was a look, you know, a flamboyancy. And I felt like maybe there was a culture to embrace.
Oh, totally.
To then be like, you know what, I'm going to be this culture, which was interesting because when I came out, I struggled with my sexuality. I struggled to tell my mum, and she said something to me, which I'm pretty sure she's going to listen to this now and think, I don't remember saying that. But the one thing that I took away from it was that she said, you don't have to give yourself up to the culture of this, because I was more scared about being that. Like, I didn't want to be the flamboyant person. I felt less likely to want to embrace the culture. I more wanted to carve a very different side of my sexuality?
This is complicated and interesting. I mean, there's a number of things. I mean, something I never particularly felt threatened or worried about that. I've never tried to be straight acting or not. I mean, I'm just who I am. That's not something I've particularly thought about. What I did encounter very early on was a sort of interesting culture of, I don't know quite what the right word is, it was a sort of self-pitying, almost making an art form out of being sad. I mean, I remember watching, there was a very famous film made, I think in the early 80s, called The Naked Civil Servant, about Quentin Crisp.
Who is that?
Quentin Crisp was a very flamboyant sort of guy in the UK, and he uses the term rough trade, and there's this idea that if you sleep with a man, that makes him somehow less of a man, so you're attracted to. And there was this whole idea that you can never have a successful gay relationship. All gay men were going to be lonely, sad, sorrowful people. And this was the sort of thinking that existed, and was, to some extent, it was certainly what the straight world suggested, and clearly rubbish. But it was also wound up with ideas of class and sexuality and masculinity.
Mm.
And there was a very narrow view. Masculinity was defined as, you know, screwing women. And there was this whole, and there was this fear that ultimately I was going to be alone, that one could not have meaningful gay relationships.
But it's interesting because you talked about this before. At a young age, when you were exploring your sexuality, you talked about cruising. And cruising is, you know, going to parks or escaping your house or your comforts to go out and find people in public places.
Yeah, and it's fleeting and it's casual sex. And there was a period for the first 2 or 3 years, I must have had sex on a beach and I had not talked to anybody. I'd had sex, you know, 50, 60, 100 men. And let's be honest about this. And yet I hadn't talked to any of them.
And how old were you when that was all happening?
Well, I started having, you know, I was 16, right through till about 17, 18.
Was it instant gratification that you were looking for? Is that why you were cruising?
You went cruising because you wanted sex and you were horny. You know, I was 17, 18 and I was horny. Then it also becomes in itself an exciting world. That sort of, it was a whole world of, and again, in 100 Men, we talk to people who talk about this and you know, you go and it's exciting and you don't know what's going to happen and it's got its rituals.
So you would say that it was like you're an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah. It became exciting in itself. But, I mean, the reason I went there was because I wanted sex. I mean, obviously. But
how terrifying to think about, like, imagine your parents. They'd be like, oh, you know, where's Paul? And you are on the beach at nighttime.
Yeah, I mean, it was all totally top secret. I mean, there was a period in which I was a deacon in the church. I was going to school, the last year of school. And I was, you know, I had a car quite young and I was spending the nights going to, what do you call them here? Do you call them beats or something, I think?
They're called beats, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to, you know, the parks and toilets and beaches of Auckland City, you know.
What did your parents think you were doing?
Oh, they thought I was out with my friends, you know. And I shifted out from house quite early on. I mean, I shifted into a flat. You know, in those days it was much cheaper and easier. You went flatting. I went to university for a year before I, you know, fell in love and started making films.
If you could go back and have a conversation with Paul at the age of 12, what advice would you give Paul?
Do exactly what you did.
Just do it the same way.
I have no regrets. Possibly I'd suggest that I experimented with, I thought I was 100% gay and didn't have sex with a woman till very late on in my life. And I'd probably suggest to that explore that a little bit earlier. That would be my only advice. But that's probably...
What was wrong with exploring that in your later life?
Oh, it was fabulous, which is why I said I should have explored it earlier.
Oh, okay. So you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, I you know, it was something that... It was a bizarre, and it's in the film. We talk about it. And
yeah.
It was like I was seeing this guy who's bisexual, and he said, oh, I've told my wife about you, and you've got to try it. And, you know, and it was a brief exploration of that world. And I'm now, instead of 100% gay, I'm sort of 98.9%. But anyhow, yeah.
Do you think that maybe the escapism, in a way, when you talk about writers, TV shows, cinema, do you think that that was the reason why you got into filmmaking? Is that where the love of filmmaking came from, that there was a sense of escapism for you?
Oh, no, look, I mean, I, you know, certainly as a young guy, I struggled with my sexuality and the religious thing, and it was a huge struggle. And I was angry at the world and full of angst and all the usual teenage angst that anybody has anyhow. I mean, you know, it's not just gay people who go through all of these things, obviously. But it was coloured by that, and I knew there was... And in fact, I went off to become a preacher and I went to a seminary and started doing theology course.
What age were you when that happened?
I was 17, yeah. I spent a year down at this Seventh-day Adventist seminary.
So you've been having promiscuous sex on the beach,
yep.
And then I got to 17 and...
I prayed, I said to God, right... I'll give my life to you, make me straight, and I'll go off and become a preacher.
So your parents didn't put that upon you? No, you decided
no,
to...
No, absolutely. I was still struggling with the religious thing, the gay, and...
So you wanted to pray the gay away?
Yeah, absolutely. And I went off and nearly went mad. I mean, again, this is in the film, and it was extreme. I mean, I don't talk about this in the film in great detail, but I mean, I started to hallucinate. There was high-pitched screaming, and the world was terrible. You know, I was really struggling with it, and it became very intense. And then I just gave up. I thought, like, I don't want to go mad. And I then discovered movies around that time. And even that, interestingly, the interesting thing is that the church, which is a very Puritan church, taught that movies are from the devil. So even that, I mean, not entirely, but certainly mainstream movies and rock music and all of, and again, these things were all confused and muddled. But I then fell in love with movies because I had all this anger and confusion. And then suddenly there was this amazing massive screen which was exploring big emotional things. And I wanted to become a filmmaker. And I was 17 and said, I don't want to be a preacher anymore. I want to be a filmmaker, and have carried on ever since.
Well, I'm kind of glad that you did.
The other thing is, I also at that point thought, and it's weird because, and it hasn't changed. I just thought, right, for me, I want to explore how one can, maybe it was the religious background, how we can make things better. And I, as I said, for me, I wanted heroes. I wanted my own heroes. I wanted to see gay men lead interesting and exciting lives. I think I even wrote a comic with a gay hero, which we still haven't seen much of in mainstream. So
it's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't know if it ever will. The interesting thing, and I go back to this thing, equality is there, but we're not the same. And there's a whole separate thing which is to do with commercial imperative in terms of Hollywood. And those big action films take huge amounts of money. And we might see an emasculated... I'm getting into hot water here. We might see a sort of watered-down gay, often side characters. A central gay character who leads... a real gay life. But the reality is that it's about commercial. I mean, 100 Men, it's a little documentary. It was funded by the New Zealand Film Commission, but it's really only ever reached an audience in gay film festivals. The truth is Netflix have picked it up. And this is an exciting thing in terms of being able to, the way the industry's changing.
Mm.
But I think in terms of big blockbusters, the money involved, it's very hard. And I mean, this is not just gay. I mean, we finally, after how many years, have seen, you know, black heroes.
This is the thing, is that you can't exactly say that, because you would 100% go back 10 years and you would never believe, and I don't even think 6 months ago, we believed that Black Panther was going to make the money.
No.
And I read a really interesting article on it that said, we are racist if Black Panther doesn't make the money.
Sure.
But I think people are coming a long way. We are breaking those stereotypes down.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I would never have thought gay marriage, gay characters, well-rounded gay characters on Star Trek, unthinkable, you know, 5 years ago, let alone 10, 20, 30 years ago. But, and this is one of the things where, you know, equality is fantastic, but there is also with that, and this is what I've tried to explore in 100 Men, comes, there are strings attached. And there's this whole, the idea of, you know, it's interesting in the sense that, you know, 100 Men, I go and explore history through talking to people I've had sex with. And obviously I approach lots of people. And there was one particular person that I would have loved to have had in the documentary. He was a good friend. And we used to go clubbing together and had a fantastic time. And he's now met this wonderful guy and they're happily married. And he's become a headmaster. And this is in the UK.
So he doesn't want to be in your documentary.
No. Now, this is what's interesting. He's openly gay. They've had a marriage, invited, you know, all his school friends. It's totally fine. I know from personal experience that they have an open relationship. What he doesn't want is the truth of their relationship and the way they live. He wants to conform to that heteronormative view of marriage, which is defined in the monogamy and to some extent religious. And indeed, there is a, you know, there's all sorts of strings attached. And I think there's pressure on young gay. I mean, again, it's been really interesting doing this documentary, one of the screenings in LA. There's a huge argument occur between Older and this young guy who said, well, that was really interesting, but that's how gay men had to live, you know, that promiscuous lifestyle. It's a bit sad. You need to fall in love. And now that we're normal, we don't need to live like that anymore. And we can, you know, get married and live happily ever after. Well, there are issues around that.
There's certainly issues around that. And we're going to get into that a little bit later. What do you think makes a good filmmaker?
Ah, telling a story. I mean, look, I love film, and I have always, you know, fell in love with films as a, you know, confused little teenager, and have continued to love every sort of film. And, you know, and there have been some great other, I mean, I'll tell you, one of the other greatest gay filmmakers that isn't perhaps recognized as much as he should be is a guy called John Schlesinger, who made some amazing films in Midnight Cowboy, which was a fabulous film. And you look at it, you know, it's unbelievable in some of the things that he made. And he made another film called Sunday Bloody Sunday, which is about a bisexual relationship back in the 70s, and I still haven't seen bisexuality really explored in films. But many years ago, I got into it because I believed about it, but then I then had to make a living and became a television filmmaker and documentaries, and I did documentaries about science fiction. Many years ago, I was privileged to interview an old director called Robert Wise, who was the director, might have been the producer actually, of Sound of Music. He was the editor of Citizen Kane, and had Oscars, I think something like 6 Oscars, West Side Story, and just, I mean, you know, and he was in his late 70s, early 80s, wonderful guy. And I asked him about a particular film, which he was very famous for in the 50s, and the special effects. And he said, look, special effect, forget it. They're not important. Great characters, a good story. And his eyes lit up, and, you know, he said, that's all that you need. And that's the truth. A great character's good story.
Well, I think that's exactly where the truth is in your work. You know, the work that you do is about storytelling of real people's lives.
As far as I'm concerned, you know, there are lots of fantastic filmmakers out there making amazing films. There aren't enough gay filmmakers who are making things that genuinely explore the issues that can't be explored elsewhere, partly because of the commercial realities. That's, you know, and even the funding for this, it was actually an accident. It didn't get funded because, I mean, we've had amazing support from the New Zealand Film Commission, but the people who put the money into it, because it was also, I'm going to be a little bit careful here, but I'm not sure they fully knew what they were getting. And they were hoping that it would cross over and reach a wide audience. That's the holy grail in filmmaking, you know, crossover.
Again, it gets put back into its minority, though.
Yeah.
It gets put back into its category.
Does. Yeah.
But I think that at the same time, and you've learnt this over time, I think, is that you've continued to connect to your work and you've continued to tell your story and you've...
Yeah, it's been a struggle.
But it's been a struggle.
It's been a huge struggle. And, you know, I've never had serious funding for my projects. I'm battling to get a new film off the ground. Every film has been 8-9 year battle. Every single film. It's hard. And there are other filmmakers that I respect who've given up. Great filmmakers, some fantastic, and they're not at the top of my head, but, you know, I know that some of the British filmmakers, that they've just given up because it's so hard.
What training did you get to become a filmmaker?
I left New Zealand and went to the UK, and I got into editing, which is my bread and butter. Basically, and obviously in the documentary, I got a part-time job in a sex cinema cutting out the sort of, like, you know, the naughty shots, because in those days you weren't allowed to show any naughty shots. So we were tipped off before a police raid and, you know.
You'd splice them out.
You'd splice them out. It was a physical cut. And then when the police came and raided, you know, in those days there was a projector that, you know, spooled.
Did you have trouble going through those films looking for those shots?
No, not that much trouble, but
there's probably worse jobs for gay men.
Yeah, no, look, and to be honest, it was also actually a wonderful environment. I then very rapidly realised, and I joined other filmmakers, and I learnt a craft, and I became initially an assistant editor, and I did that for 2 years. Actually, I did it for about 3 years with a little arts company in the UK. Had to earn money, worked in the sex shop, but I actually got work at the BBC syncing up rushes, which is what you did in those days. It was a mechanical, physical process. And then slowly, very much worked in the industry and did learn huge amounts working with professional people. And that was parallel to exploring the things I wanted to explore. Mm. And I continue to survive as an editor. Hopefully I've learned how to edit films after all these years. And that's my bread and butter. I still don't make a living out of my work as a gay filmmaker. I make a living as an editor. And I work on mainstream television. And eventually ended up enjoying working on things that weren't gay. I did a whole series for the History Channel. I looked at the Second World War, which I talked about earlier. I did, you know, a whole series about books, and I did a whole range of other things. I did a documentary about Diana, and these were mainstream current affairs, and I used the skills to make a living. And as I said, I have never really made a living out of, you know, the gay films that I've made. None of them have made.
We get to sort of tour. So you're here for the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, but I mean, that's kind of like a side thing to the fact that you've made all of your money out of editing.
You get the airfare and the hotel.
Yeah, people don't necessarily know. If you're usually doing something that you're passionate about, you're not normally getting paid for it. When you went to London, what was it about London that you sort of fell in love with?
Like I said before, it was stepping into a world that I'd always read about. You know, I was an outsider, and because of that, I was suddenly at the heart of Soho and the Red Light District. And I was meeting amazing characters. Mm. And in those days, there was also an underground culture that was exciting. It was, to some extent, in those days, you know, legal drinking clubs existed. Drugs were around. Didn't really get into those till later on. It wasn't so much that. But, you know, I can remember going to these little places where you really still had a little door, a little sort of grate door would open, and some leery drag queen would peer out at you, and you'd have to say the secret word before you'd be let in. But then when you went in, you discovered the most amazing array of people, and there really were sort of like, I remember going to this particular club, and Liza Minnelli was there. And I just thought, you know, I was 23, 24, in a club seeing somebody who, and you know, there's a connection to Isherwood and Cabaret, and a huge movie star. So
in these secret clubs.
Yeah, absolutely. In those days, you know, they were the cool places to go. And it was like, yeah, it was an excuse to meet amazing characters and larger than life people, but also really interesting people, intellectuals. I met Francis Bacon, who was an amazing, famous painter. And these were people who changed the world.
You also slept with someone who was quite famous, I believe.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're talking about Freddie Mercury, are you?
Mm. Well, I'm going to say
I mean, it wasn't slept with. I had sex briefly in an orgy. I mean, it's hardly sleeping with.
Still, Freddie Mercury from Queen.
To be honest with you, A, it was before he was really that famous. I mean, this is going right back. And it was like, you know, I had sex with him. I didn't even know who he was. And somebody said, oh, that's Freddie Mercury. You realize you just had sex? And by that time, there was somebody else who was more exciting around the corner. And I thought, oh, great. And I was busy chasing somebody else who I thought was more exciting. So, you know, yeah.
But you still slept with Freddie Mercury.
Had sex. Slept is a different thing.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
All right.
Tell us the story about how you ended up making 100 Men.
It was very organic. It was something I was developing a feature script and trying to get the New Zealand Film Commission to put money into it. And I had, for a number of years, been filming little interviews with people, primarily as background research for documentaries. And there's one character in the film called James Samoan who has an amazing life story, and I just wanted to make a film about him. So I'd done an interview, and in fact it was done on a ropey old camera and I couldn't use it, so we had to redo it. And in fact several of the interviews that I were either salvaged from very poor quality footage or we had to redo. But I'd built up, you know, a number of interviews over 5 or 6 years. When I got back to New Zealand, I had a lot of time because I spent time in the UK and then came back to New Zealand. And I had a lot of time on my hands. And I literally sat down and thought, I want to write a list, as it's called, you know, the list of people that I've met, because I don't want to forget them. And then talking to a producer friend of mine who I've worked a lot with in the UK, she said, well, look, wouldn't this make an interesting historical documentary? So we started to play with ideas. The Film Commission heard about it, and they said, put together a test scene and see. And I'd also made films around the gay life over 30 years, not 40 years, and, you know, I'm not that old yet. But so I had a lot of archive footage of documentaries that I made over the years. So the idea grew organically, and I was never going to be in the film initially. I was going to have my voice off camera because I don't like being filmed. I've always been behind the camera. You know, I'm a director, and I've never, ever been, you know, I'm you know, just quite shy, to be honest. I don't even like being photographed. And the head of the film commission said, look, this is not going to work. The only thing that ties this together is going to be very dry and boring. It just becomes a countdown. You need to, you know, inject more of yourself, and you're going to have to be on camera. And we'll commission this and give you the money to make it. And there was an American distributor who got involved, and they liked the idea of it. And I sort of said, okay, bite the bullet, we'll give it a go. And so they said, fine. And then there was, it happened then very rapidly, because once they said, let's go for it, suddenly I had to pull it all together. And there was a sort of 6-8 month period in which they gave me the money to go and do some more interviews, do some editing, and, you know,
pull it all together.
I mean, it wasn't a huge budget, and there was a lot of things. I would have loved to have had more music in it from the period, but, you know, clearance, and because it's a film, you have to clear things for the world. And, you know, I wanted a Lou Reed track. Well, they...
not as easily accessible.
They wanted something like, I think, for worldwide clearance for 30 seconds, they asked for $70,000. And that was for 30 seconds of a Lou Reed track.
No, thank you.
And there were a number of people, and even some gay artists that I would have really loved to have had in the film. We have a couple, and I have a great soundtrack, and a friend of mine helped write some stuff, and we got music from all over the place. So, and I would have liked to have done more interviews. There were people that I just couldn't afford to go to. There was a person in New York that I just couldn't afford to get to. You know, we ran out of money. So, you know, every filmmaker would like to do it better. So,
but ultimately, what would you say the premise is?
It's an exploration of how things have changed for gay men through a countdown of people I've had sex with. That's the premise. It grows beyond that, and at its heart, there is actually a love story, because I think the thing that is important, and growing up, there was this idea that I was never going to have a happy life as a gay man. Well, actually, I have. And I was very lucky, and I met somebody early on, and we struggled through all sorts of things and survived the horrors of the 80s and AIDS, and we also struggled the whole question around
monogamy.
Yeah, absolutely. And so all of these things are explored, and at its heart, it's a love story. And the other thing is, I broke my rule. Rules are made to be broken. And as I did interviews, I kept coming across people who I hadn't slept with who had amazing things to say. So although it's a countdown and we make it very clear, people are given a number, there are also interviews with a few people who are not on the list. And there's a wonderful old guy who, in fact, I'd gone to his place because they had a collection of magazines, and somebody on the list was in a magazine. And he was just telling me about what it was like. And he was in his late 70s, and he was telling me about what it was like before law reform. And I just, you know, he was just such a wonderful character that we did an interview, and it's one of the highlights of the film.
I think what's interesting about this particular documentary is that a lot of people are interested in viewing it, because coming over from New Zealand to the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, there's an enormous amount of people wanting to come along and see this film because it actually is highly relatable.
It's been in festivals, and it's been wonderful that a number, not everybody, and, you know, it's not been some amazing blockbuster or high profile. It's not some, you know, the hit of the festival or anything, but a number of gay men, particularly older gay men, have come up afterwards and been really quite moving. Some of them have been really, and we've even had tears, and people have come up and hugged me and said, look, that's my story and I love it. And I'm really, it's wonderfully rewarding, and I was never sure that it would work, and it was scary. And I the first screening in Los Angeles at the Outfest was the first time I'd seen it with an audience, and it was amazing to see so many, particularly older gay men, and the few younger gay men who've seen it have said they found it interesting for different reasons.
Is there different levels of satisfaction that you have between its success versus your ability to be happy with it as a finished product?
Yeah, I'm never happy, and, you know, there are holes that I'm not happy with. There's structural things that I think could be done better. And actually, there are a couple of things that I would do slightly different, but that's of every film.
But would you prefer to have a film that does really well, or would you be happier with you being okay with the finished product? What's the different level of satisfaction between those two things?
I would prefer a film that I was really happy with, I suppose. I don't know.
Because, like, we're not going to be on this earth for forever, and someone's going to find that film, and if it says something that you genuinely feel like you've connected with and you're happy with, I'd prefer to have that over millions of dollars.
Yeah, I guess so. I'd like both.
She wants both.
I like both. Yeah, no, I want both.
It's okay. It's so funny, though. It's an interesting thing because, you know, for an enormous amount of LGBTI influencers, clearly what it is that they do has put them on the map for a reason, and different people value different levels of success.
Hmm.
And your success, for me, when I'm hearing your story, is that I go, wow, you've really made an impact.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are people who've made bigger impacts in different ways, and you know, and you asked about great filmmakers, you know, John Waters is another one we've missed off the list, Gus Van Sant, you know, who's made some amazing stuff, and I love some of his earlier work, and these are great filmmakers who are gay, who have crossed over and become commercially successful to a degree. I mean, you know, they'd probably question how successful. I mean, again,
everyone wants more.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But everyone wants more of something.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I come back to the thing that I'm really passionate about. I think there is still a space for the niche, the gay film festivals. That and look, you know, every filmmaker has his own story and his own vision and their own voice. I mean, not gay, but Wes Anderson is a fantastic filmmaker, and he's got such a distinctive style. Mm. You know. You just think, wow, you know, every time he brings out a new film, I want to see what it is. And they're always his film, you know?
We've been on a real journey with the landscape of the LGBTI community, and so many things have changed. We've had marriage equality. If you look back at it, where do you think we've been? Like, what was the hardest thing that you've experienced being a gay man?
Oh, eight. I mean, you cannot even. I mean, there was a period, late 80s, early 90s, and again, so many friends died. I went to hospital and funerals, and it was just horrific. You know?
How do you think you escaped that mode?
And luck. I mean, it was. Look, I met a guy, and I asked him to be in the film. He elected not to, and you know, we had safe sex, and he was adamant that he was never going to not have safe sex. He fell in love with somebody, and sure enough,
he contracted.
Yeah. Another friend I know had unsafe sex once, and I mean, look, it was a luck thing, but it's not just the contract. I mean, one of the numbers in the film, and one of the, you know, we go through. I mean, I can't remember which number it is now in front of me, but you know, he's called people are given little names in the film, and he's called Charing Cross Boy. And I met him in a pub in Charing Cross, and I think he was 22, 23, and we fancied each other. And I said, "Look, you know, do you want to come back?" And this was late 80s, and he said, "I'm HIV positive," and I said, "Well, you know, we can have safe sex." And he'd only just been told this, I think, the previous day. And in those days, it was a death sentence. It meant that he was likely to die in the next year, 2 years, 3 years, and horribly. And I said, "Look, come back." And he said, "Look, I'll come back." And we talked. And as I said, I like talking to people. And his parents didn't know he was gay, let alone HIV positive. None of his friends. He was a student. And his life was going to end at 22, 23. And it was very sad, and I remember he ended up crying and just wanting to be hugged. People who haven't lived through it, it's the fear of being tested, the fear of passing it on, the fear of, I mean, it was a tragedy. And the prejudice that came along with it, it was a horrific period.
And such a thing, you know, a luck that you got through that, you know, which, you know, expressed so eloquently.
Yeah.
And then if you're looking forward at the LGBTI community, what struggles do you think that we still face?
The biggest struggle, and this is something I try and explore in the film, is hanging on to our identity and continuing to have a voice, and a voice that is honest in a world that is accepting. You know, I think there's huge pressure to conform. And for me, the joy of being a younger gay man was that I was part of. And it wasn't, I mean, it's interesting because it wasn't just about being gay. It was, but that gave me an excuse to be an outsider. And, you know, I did amazing things where I became involved with, you know, musicians, because it almost became a badge of honor. And I ended up filming very early on, when she was at the height of her power, Grace Jones. I met David Bowie, nothing to do with sex, but because I was a gay filmmaker making out exciting, dangerous stuff. And I met amazing, I was part of the world of outsiders. And you had a sort of license to be part of this, to explore it. You had a license to feel. And I could feel in a strange sort of way that when Lou Reed was singing about Lady Day or some of the other amazing things he sang about, he was singing about my world and I was part of that. And that was a two-way thing. You know, photographers, other filmmakers, and not just gay filmmakers, but filmmakers who were exploring other outsider cultures or being politically active. And one of the interesting things in the film, there was a huge political movement, and Margaret Thatcher came in during the 80s and was very conservative and introduced a famous law that banned any promotion of homosexuality in any government-run organization, which meant schools, and it was called Clause 28, and it became an enormous sort of rallying point. And it became a rallying point for everybody. And I remember going to, you know, it's not like Gay Pride or Mardi Gras. There were thousands of people who were angry, and this was not gay people, it was everybody.
Well, it's pretty disgusting behavior.
Yeah, and the demonstrations and the politics and the movement, it was strong, it was powerful. Okay. And likewise, the ACT UP and later on the fight to get funding for AIDS research, these were all important big issues that you were part of. So looking forward, I don't know, you know, I think the interesting area is Asia. You know, in New Zealand, we are suddenly part of the Pacific, we're part of Asia. I think there's an emerging, fascinating things happening. There are loads of friends of mine who are going out with, you know, people from China, and they are starting to explore an LGBT presence in China. India is still a huge struggle. But so I think these are the new fronts that one needs to explore, and that's not something that, you know, is for me, but hopefully
it will be explored. I mean, there's still some struggles that we've learnt from that maybe we can help them get through as well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We're talking about monogamy before. Like, obviously, through your life, you've been able to go through different emotions and you've tried different things. What's your feeling on gay relationships now? Do you think it's becoming more normal to have open relationships?
I think, look, I wouldn't know, to be honest. I think the vast majority of gay men that I know, in some form or other, have a form of open relationship.
Are you in an open relationship?
Yes, obviously. If I'm sleeping with hundreds of people, of course I'm in an open relationship.
Well, you might have closed it off.
Yes, this is true. And I know gay men who were promiscuous who do close it off. And this indeed does happen. In fact, you know, a good friend of mine, I think he's sort of got to the point where he's just about done everything and been everywhere, done everything, got to the point where he said, oh, you know, I can't be bothered anymore. Let's just... And indeed, some people, you know, they do threesomes, and other people say, look, you go and play away from home, just don't bring it into my house. And I think, and then others sort of say, well, I'm just going to turn a blind eye, and he may be going off doing stuff, but I don't want to know. And then there are other people who actually swear that they're being monogamous, and I meet them a week later on Grindr being not monogamous. So I think honesty to some extent, but it also I think sometimes it's a matter of just working through things and seeing what works and trying things out. I'm not sure you have to always confront everything, this idea that you have to confess everything or, you know, sit down, let's have a conversation about it. I think you work through things. What's important is love, and you know when you love somebody.
You're in love with your partner.
Totally. Couldn't conceive of living without him. Couldn't conceive of we have an unusual relationship. It's lasted for years. He allows me to make the films I make, and, you know, I wouldn't be here without him.
Do you just not talk about any of the sex that you have behind whatever sex you're having? You just don't go into detail about it?
Yeah, I don't.
It's not out of respect for him?
Yeah, I don't rub it in his face, but, you know, he'll sort of occasionally he'll joke and make some silly joke about it. And
is he going off and having sex with other people?
He has done, obviously. He possibly has less of a sort of, I mean, I think he's less obsessed by sex than I am.
He's got other hobbies.
He likes, you know, he likes pottering around the house, and he likes his dog. But, you know, it's difficult. I mean, there are lots of...
Are you still having a sexual relationship with him, though?
We have our moments from time to time. I mean, after many years, they tend to be few and far between, but, you know...
Someone said to me the other day, they were like, you know what, sometimes we'll have sex 4 days in a row, but then sometimes we won't have sex for a year, and I'm like, sex for you is like Easter.
Yeah.
I'm like,
yeah. I mean, I don't think, you know, look, it everybody's different, and I don't, you know, in the film I don't go into detail of what people do in bed. And, you know, and I think there are areas, and but it's difficult. I mean, there's a degree of honesty where quite difficult to. I remember years ago we had a dog, and you know, my partner's crazy about a dog. His dog's big white fluffy Samoyeds, and we had some friends around, and we were sort of literally having afternoon tea, and Loki's the name of the dog, came bouncing in with this giant dildo that he had discovered under the bed, which was embarrassing and difficult to sort of... it was hilarious. And, of course, he just thought this was the greatest toy out. And, so it was difficult to pretend that... But, and we made a joke of it. That was a joke. It's not... It wasn't heavy.
The dildo wasn't heavy.
No. Well, it was a big one. the thing is, my partner and I, we found ways that worked for us. And we were honest about things in a quiet and gentle way. And... Look, I don't know. Maybe he'll meet somebody and fall madly in love and it will all come crashing down. There's no guarantee in life. But I love him totally and I believe he loves me totally.
And, why wouldn't he?
And, you'd have to ask him that. But I don't think...
What about the idea of this, though? Like, if people are saying they're in a close relationship, they're living a dangerous life because, ultimately, men can be very promiscuous. So men could often be going off and having sex behind their back. Does that make you feel as though all gay men should take PrEP or people should be prepared?
No. Look, I think the PrEP's a whole different discussion in the sense that one chooses to have unsafe sex and PrEP's a new thing. It hasn't really, it wasn't around. Mm. It's only a recent thing. And maybe if I was younger, I'd consider taking it. But... for example, over the years, I've met people and have had relationships and they've been affairs. And my partner has met them and they've enriched our lives. He has also had affairs and I've become very close friends. One of the characters in the film that I interview was really John's friend rather than mine. And they had sex, for a little bit. And then he became a friend. And we all stopped having sex. It wasn't sort of, we've never done threesomes. It's not our thing. For me, the promiscuity has been about enriching and meeting interesting people.
It's about cultivating a life that works for you.
That's right.
So who cares what happens in other people's relationships, really? You're happy for people to do what they feel comfortable with.
Exactly. And I wouldn't. And if somebody wants to be monogamous, and the weird thing is now I've actually met a couple of people that I see on a regular basis and I'm almost semi-monogamous because, I'm really happy with just a couple of regulars. I'm not that interested in going on Grindr and...
Looking for it anymore.
Well, who knows, but...
What do you think now with the landscape changing with the marriage equality? Do you think that... There's a lot of people saying that now that marriage equality has happened, it's like someone said to me last week, we've changed it now, so people don't have anything to complain about. How do you feel about the legislation changing? Do you think that is a huge weight that's been lifted? New Zealand had happened a long time before Australia.
Yeah, no, it did. And it was a huge... obviously, the debate here was, we watched it from there. And again, in the film, it's absolutely an important thing. And for me, the... ability. For me, that marriage, and I have no desire to get married. We had a civil partnership, and that was to do with legality, but there was something nice about it. And this was before marriage, way back when it was first civil partnerships. Mm. But, marriage is about, it's a symbolic thing, it's a ritual. And I think it's terribly important. And rituals are important. It goes back to the religious thing, funerals, marriage. These are things that signify and show society's acceptance. And I think it is a breakthrough and it is amazing. It's unthinkable. And alongside that, there are gay men and obviously gay women who want to adopt children and, create families and focus on that sort of thing. And that's fantastic. My concern and the thing that I've tried to explore in my work is, and not just 100 Men, but in other things as well, and I'm developing a new film now, which is very much about some of these subjects. I think gay people, the truth is that we are actually quite a small minority. And, in central big cities, my partner lives in Rotorua. It's a small little town. It's not, you don't see gay people. It's not like being in the centre of Melbourne, the centre of London, San Francisco. And I think it's about 3% of the population is roughly seen as being sort of, predominantly gay or gay for the bulk of their life, whatever it is. And you split that, 50-50 men, women, it's a very small group of people. Trans is, another even smaller, And I worry that one will get squashed and lost. The heteronormative, to use that horrible word, view of the world is can be so easily imposed. And, you know, I think it's important to retain our uniqueness. And there are certain shared experiences. Coming out, I think, is still a huge hurdle for a lot of people, not everybody. And I think it's important to be proud of who you are still. You know, and
it's funny though, like it's almost like it's splitting off into two different categories where people are like, I just want to be treated like everybody else, but at the same time, I want to be appreciated for my sexuality or for my difference.
Yeah. And I think it you know, I think when you say you want to be treated by like everybody else, we're not like everybody else, we're special.
If we peel it back, because the interesting thing about you is that you are from New Zealand and you are sort of ahead of us by about 5 years, because, you know, it's almost like you're watching 5 years ahead of us on Home and Away or Neighbours. You know, you're 5 years or... Okay. What do you think has changed in New Zealand that you think will happen here in Australia in a way, culturally?
Well, I think the interest... And you know, look, they are very different countries. And I think, you know, New Zealand is very much more about being part of the Pacific. And certainly in Auckland, where I live, there is a huge Pacific Island culture. And, you know, Maori is obviously a big part of New Zealand. There's now a massive influx of Asian, both from India and China and other, you know, other Asian countries. So I think what is really interesting is the diversity within, you know, LGBTI, but also within that, you know, within race. And I think there are hurdles there. I spoke earlier about the religious backdrop in terms of the Pacific Island cultures. I think culturally in China, there are, you know, huge issues and understanding India again. So in New Zealand, I think the interesting area is around how there's an emerging gay Asian, gay Pacific Island, gay Maori arts, culture, and that's exciting.
So do you reckon that by New Zealand then attracted people from neighbouring countries that recognised that it was a safer place for them to live?
Absolutely.
We are very behind when it comes to New Zealand. I mean, New Zealand have done things that have definitely needed to happen in Australia well before us.
You can't separate the world, and it's a global world. What is interesting, and I don't know exactly the facts and figures, but recently I was doing some work on the new film I was exploring, and there is a huge swing to the right in Europe and in America, you know, Trump and Brexit and even just recently Italy. And it's incredibly alarming. The figures around homophobic attacks have shot up in Germany, in Italy, in the UK and in America in the last 3 or 4 years. But very noticeable has been an increase in hate crimes directed towards LGBT people. And, you know, you need to do some research on this, but I remember reading these figures and thinking, this is scary. And it is linked to this swing to the right. Religion is still absolutely at the heart of a lot of, you know, there are vast bulk of world religions are still... They still see gay people as sinful, if you're told.
Definitely.
That.
I think, you know, when you look at the world and you look at the biggest problems that we have in the world, they usually come down to a confluence of people who don't agree, that can't live together, just understanding that they support their own beliefs.
Yeah. And you know, as I said, you know, there's a rise of the right across the world at the moment, and conservatism. You know, that's having an effect. And certainly in New Zealand, the religious aspect of the Pacific Island, I mean, they are very religious and they are all in religions that are absolutely anti-gay. And I cannot tell you the number of people I've met who, you know, are leading double lives, because it would be inconceivable for them to come out, and they're going to get married and, you know, do the dutiful thing. And it's sad.
I think that is sad. One of the other things I was going to say is, are people out there who might want to work being a filmmaker, what advice do you have for them wanting to get into this?
An aspect of filmmaking that you can earn a living from, whether it's a camera person, a sound, or editing, or production managing, or first assistant, find an ability to make money so that you can survive. And at the same time, that will feed into exploring the passions. And, you know, just explore the things that you want to do. Be true to yourself. You said that earlier, you know.
Like, do the things that can make you the money, but then also do the things that about your passions.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that, you know, my advice would be if you free yourself up, if you're constantly trying to make a living by being passionate about something, you know, there's a conflict there and you will struggle. You may not, but there are very few filmmakers that get to make the things they really want to make and make a living out of it. There are some, and it's possible, and maybe that's a mistake. Maybe I should have been more, you know, I don't know, it's too late. And as I said, I don't have regrets. But that would be my advice, would be, you know, find, you know, but not, you know, don't go and do dishes to make a living. Do something that complements so that you learn. And, you know, my skill as an editor hopefully has helped me become a better filmmaker.
Have you got a message for the queer community, the people that are listening to this right now?
I watch my film. It's coming out on Netflix later this year. You know, I'm a filmmaker and I make films for people to watch. And if they're interested, as I said, I think it's the end of this month, actually. It's on Netflix in Australia, which I'm really proud of. It's a fantastic brand to be associated with. And anybody who wants to see it, Netflix is changing the world. It's fantastic. They're doing some other exciting stuff.
It's changing the landscape of the way that people are being able to obtain their entertainment, which is great. Your film is being played at the Melbourne Queer Film Festival at the moment, so if people want to go out and see it, they can. And if they want to follow you on social media, how can they do that?
We have a Facebook page, and I'm not even sure what it is, but it's 100 Men Facebook or something. I should know what it is, but I'm hopeless.
Amazing. And I want to thank you so much for coming in here today and having this conversation about a plethora of things.
I hope you can edit it. Thank you.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.